Morning by Lyndon Jones.
One of the highlights of 2012 on Radio 3 was our complete broadcast of Wagner's Ring Cycle, live from the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden. You may have found the prospect of total immersion in those gargantuan spans of music a bit daunting. So over the Christmas period, we've made the experience more easily digestible, we hope, by giving you a one-act-sized parcel of the ring to open each day, beginning on Christmas Eve. The Royal Opera's Ring was one of the hottest tickets of the year, despite the Olympics, and the cast is headed by Bryn Terfel, described as captivating, compelling, and enthralling as Wotan, the chief of the gods. Wagner's Ring Cycle, in the production from the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, act by act over Christmas, beginning tomorrow at 4:30 on BBC Radio 3.
Another reason you can't wait for Christmas. This is BBC Radio 3. It's just gone midday and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay. And for fans of radio programmes of years gone by, we begin with a trip down memory lane.
My Christmas guest is Dame Diana Rigg. Diana, before I introduce you more formally, as everyone can hear, we've taken a slight diversion because you've asked for this montage of pieces that remain very much in your mind and have a very particular sentimental attraction for you, don't they?
Yes, they do.
We heard the Dick Barton theme, the Paul Temple theme, Calling All the Workers, which was used for Music While You Work. And then, of course, Portrait of a Flirt, which was used for In Town Tonight by Robert Farnon.
Yes, it was an interview programme, much as you see on television nowadays, of all the rich and famous people who are flying into London to appear on the stage or on films and things. And that was a highlight of my week. I remember the theme was a policeman blowing his whistle and we stopped the mighty roar of London's traffic to bring you, and then the list of stars. But secondary to that was Saturday Night Theatre, which entirely fired my imagination. And I think it was partly because of that and my love of poetry and words that I ended up on the stage.
Now, you have had and still have an extremely illustrious career on stage, radio, as you've already suggested, and screen. I mean, personally, I think of Medea at the Almeida, Regan in King Lear, just to name but two. But I guess you're universally known as the leather-clad Emma Peel in The Avengers, and as the one woman who actually got to marry James Bond on Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Yes, I don't mind that at all. I think the series was extraordinarily potent for its time, and particularly for women. And a lot of now middle-aged women come up to me and say, you know, Emma Peel was a leading light for me. She taught me that women could do everything and could be in charge of their lives and their futures. So I'm really very grateful to the Avengers for plunging me into worldwide stardom, I suppose.
Well, I have to tell you, Diana, speaking on behalf of the male population, that we rather enjoyed it too.
Good.
Has music always been important to you?
Yes, always. It was my brother, actually, who introduced me to the first piece of classical music that has stayed with me forever. And I remember both of us listening to it and getting so excited by the power of this piece of music.
And it has, doesn't it, the full-blooded emotion of the Russian school?
Yes, very much so.
And the opening chords, you can't really forget.
You're
them.
Stunned by them, aren't you?
And then the piano comes in, since we were talking about the Avengers, as a kind of combatant with the orchestra, almost.
Up to a point, but then, of course, they join, and that is the beauty of it. It's like two combatants, but then finally they come together to form this rhapsodic music.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Music from the first movement of the Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto No. 1. We heard Marta Argerich playing the piano with the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Claudio Abbado. What I like about some of the things you've chosen, Diana Rigg, is the idea of pure sound quite often, the human voice, and actually the voice of nature.
Yes, I love particularly birdsong. I'm very lucky. I live in a house which backs onto an open space, and if I wake really early, I lie in bed with a smile on my face listening to the dawn chorus, which is absolutely glorious. But I was also very lucky because I raised, with friends, two blackbirds, two fledglings. The parents had nested in a small greenhouse attached to my house in Kensington. And we watched them going in and out, sitting on the nest, and then we could see four little heads above the rim of the nest. And then suddenly the parents stopped visiting the nest, and we could only see two little heads. And I went in after a decent interval to find out what had happened. And I think one of the fledglings had fallen on the floor and died, and there was a pathetic little corpse there. And the other one had gone out of the greenhouse, and the parents had followed it, and I was left with these two screaming fledglings. And I rang up the Royal Society of Protection of Birds, and they told me what to feed them. Best of all, they said, was worms. And I couldn't dig any worms out of the garden. So I suddenly thought there's a fishing tackle shop on Barnes Bridge, and I rang him, and he said he'd sell me a pint of Pinkies for £5. So I'd sent a taxi round. And we
You sent a taxi round for the worms?
For the Pinkies, yes, absolutely. And we reared these birds. And it was fascinating because they had distinct personalities. One would come and sit on your foot and look up at you and scream at you for food. And the other one we had to go find and tap his beak and remind him it was time for him to be fed. And then, of course, came the time when I had to let them out to get used to the outside world. It was rather like taking one's child to school. You thought, oh, please, God, let them survive. Well, they took lodgings outside my kitchen door. And they would hop through the kitchen to the fridge where the Pinkies were kept. And they stayed there all summer. I knew it was they because one of them had a white feather in his wing. I thought, oh, dear heaven, I've fed him the wrong diet. Mother's been deficient. Anyway, eventually, of course, they flew away. But sometimes, I stop in a London street in a late afternoon and I listen to that lone blackbird singing in the tree. And I think, maybe, just maybe, it's a descendant of one of my babies.
It's an enchanting musical sound. I sometimes whistle to birds, and they do sometimes answer back.
Oh, yes, they do. Yes, I can't do it. But certainly cuckoos do, and owls do. Mm. I think you'd find it rather hard to replicate that song, though, wouldn't you?
No, I'm afraid that would defeat me. Messiaen might manage it, but it would defeat me. Now, you talked earlier, Dame Diana Rigg, about those pieces of music, which I think had a very strong reference to London for you,
yes.
Didn't they?
Yes, they did.
You've lived and worked in London for many years. But as you've just suggested, we are moving slightly more into the countryside now, and especially with this next piece.
Yes, I absolutely love the countryside. And years ago, I was introduced to trout fishing, which is, of course, a way of completely being absorbed by the countryside. You have to be very still, standing on the water, even though you're casting. You have to cast really carefully. But nature around you, if you are still, ignores the fact that you're human, and they go about their lives, you know, water rats crossing the stream and kingfishers flashing across. And Oh, it's absolutely wonderful. So trout fishing is one of the great, great joys of my life. And this is a piece of music which describes it. Well, not the fishing so much.
Yes, well, and of course, presumably it was this knowledge that made you think of the fishing tack shop to provide sustenance for blackbirds.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, it's all woven into one life.
Yeah. When you listen to this music, which is the Trout Quintet by Schubert, both in the quintet and in the song that uses the same melody, there really is a feeling somehow of the sensibility that gives it its name.
Very much so, yes. It's rippling water. Mm. And of course, a good trout stream, the really best trout streams, have a sort of chalk bottom, and the streams are really, really clear. You could see the fish underneath, a flash of silver underneath. And I think the music describes this beautifully.
Thank you. rippling sound of Arthur Schnabel at the piano, with members of the Pro Arte Quartet playing the fourth movement from the piano quintet by Schubert, the Trout, Deutsch 667. I think you were born in Yorkshire, but you spent quite a bit of early life in India.
Yes, I did, until I was seven. And then, much as most parents did in those days, it was best for us as children to be educated in England. So my mother brought us home and put us into boarding schools.
Just like Kipling, actually.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And it was, I think parents are pretty horrified nowadays at what happened. But in fact, they thought they were doing it in our best interests. And one just survived it.
It probably taught you a degree of self-sufficiency.
Yes, very much so. But sometimes that works against you because, you know, when the parents came back, we were really rather independent. And then we had to forge a new relationship based on a different appreciation of them, of me as an older, self-sufficient child, and me of parents who I hadn't actually got to know terribly well.
How did you find your way into the acting world, the world of the theatre?
Mostly through poetry and reading. I loved reading. I love words. And, of course, a teacher at school. It's always a teacher at school who said, this is what you should pursue. So it's thanks to her that I did.
I imagine the next piece you've chosen, which is a Sting number, but sung by Eva Cassidy,
yes,
is possibly because of the personality of the artist singing it.
No, it's really because of the fields of gold. I love our English fields of gold. And I thought, it's December. We need to know that we have fields of gold to look forward to.
You can tell the sun in his jealous sky when we walked in fields of gold. When we walked in fields of gold.
Eva Cassidy sang Fields of Gold by Sting. You have, Diana Rigg, a house in France, don't you?
Yes, I do. I've had it for some years now. I've always hated the fact that I couldn't speak French terribly well. I thought it was a huge gap in my knowledge. And indeed, I eventually pitched up at a school and was the oldest pupil there and learnt French and bought a house at the same time. Mind you, the French I learnt hardly helped with the house. It was mostly about plumbing and electricity and stuff like that. But I adore the French culture, the French language, the cuisine. Absolutely love it. And I came across this piece years and years ago and have always loved it. So now I have the house and this wonderful piece of music too.
And it has a kind of almost transfixing feel to it, doesn't it?
It really does.
It's slightly like a mantra.
Yes, I believe Erik Satie was a very peculiar character. I'm told he died in a room full of newspapers which he hadn't thrown away. I have a sense of this strangeness is in this piece.
Thank you.
I think when I said strange, I rather meant solitary, because it has a very lonely feel to it, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yes. I like that about it. For me, that is the perfect kind of minimalism, you know, something which is quite spare.
Yes.
It has a wonderful line to it. And then there are certain chords that when you reach them, you suddenly think, ah, yes, that's just different.
Yes.
We heard Pascal Roger playing Gymnopédie No. 1 by Erik Satie. We have a shared passion, Diana Rigg, well, probably several, but certainly one is for the poetry of the Earl of Rochester.
Yes. There's one particular poem which I'll read you, if I may.
I mean, I think, just before you do, can I just say that what we both love about him is, of course, he has a famous or a notorious, infamous reputation for his extremely naughty, sexy stuff. And Johnny Depp, indeed, played him in The Libertine, which played up that. But what I love about him, and I think what you love about him, is there's a lot of poetry which is just incredibly touching and very beautiful.
Yes, and it's full of love. It's a kind of completely uncarnal love. And specifically in this poem, which is the song of a young lady to her ancient lover. And I dedicate it to all the OAPs like myself. Ancient person, for whom I all the flattering youth defy, long be it ere thou grow old, aching, shaking, crazy, cold, but still continue as thou art, ancient person of my heart. On thy withered lips and dry, which like barren furrows lie, brooding kisses I will pour, shall thy youthful heart restore. Such kind showers in autumn fall, and a second spring recall. Nor from thee will ever part, ancient person of my heart. All a lover's wish can reach, for thy joy my love shall teach, and for thy pleasure shall improve all that art can add to love. Yet still I love thee without art, ancient person of my heart.
Mendelssohn's overture, The Hebrides, Fingal's Cave, played by the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, conducted by Vladimir Yurovsky. Now, the reason, Diana Rigg, that I went straight into that music was that I felt that you read the Earl of Rochester's A Song of a Young Lady to Her Ancient Lover quite beautifully, and I didn't want any more chatter before the music. I hope you'll forgive me. But actually, if we had had some chatter there, it would have been about your love of Scotland, wouldn't it?
Yes. I was married to a Scotsman for many years, and I grew to so love that country. It really is extraordinary, and the people as well. And I was very lucky because I did a programme once for the National Trust for Scotland, and I went to see all their, really the best holdings that they had in Scotland, and travelled by helicopter over moors and was landed on the top of mountains. And I saw for myself the extraordinary variety of countryside there is in Scotland.
Did you get to fish there?
Oh, yes.
Because that's very good, the fishing.
Very good, the fishing, yes. And I can swank about my 24.5-pound salmon.
We're going to move south a bit, because being the festive season, you're going to combine various things, the idea of Christmas, the idea of Yorkshire, where you were brought up. And perhaps you could explain why that all comes together in this choice.
Yes, it's an absolutely delightful excerpt from a book by Gervase Finn, who was a schools inspector in the Dales. And as a schools inspector, he had to attend nativity plays in all these little primary schools on his patch. And here is an excerpt of one of his experiences, and it's called No Room at the Inn. Mums and dads, grannies and grandpas, aunties and uncles, neighbours and friends filled the school hall for the nativity play, the highlight of the school year. I found a seat just as the lights dimmed and a spotlight lit up the small stage. The curtain opened to reveal the outlines of various eastern-looking houses, painted on a backdrop, and two rather forlorn palm trees made out of papier-mâché and green crepe paper, which drooped in the centre of the stage. The little boy playing the lead as Joseph entered, wearing a brightly coloured towel over his head. He took centre stage without a trace of nerves, stared at the audience, and then beckoned a particularly worried-looking Mary, who entered, pulling behind her a large cardboard and polystyrene donkey. "Come on," urged Joseph. "Hurry up." He banged on the door of one of the houses. "Open up, open up," he shouted loudly. The innkeeper threw open the door. "What?" he barked. "Have you any room?" "No, you have." "I haven't." "You have. I saw light on." "I haven't." "Luke, we've travelled all night up and down those sand dunes, through dusty towns, over hills we're fit to drop." "Can't help that. There's no room," replied the innkeeper. "And I've got a wife out there on donkey," Joseph gestured in the direction of a very glum-looking Mary, who was staring at the audience completely motionless. "She's having a babby, thou knows." "Well, I can't help that. It's nowt to do with me." "I know," replied Joseph, sighing, as he turned to the audience. "And it's nowt to do with me neither." To the surprise of the children, there were great guffaws of laughter from the audience. And so the play progressed until the final magic moment. Little rosy-faced angels in white, with cardboard wings and tinsel halos, shepherds with towels over their heads and cotton-wool beards, the three kings in coloured robes and shiny paper hats, gathered round Mary and Joseph on the cramped stage to sing Away in a Manger and bring a tear to every eye.
Away in a Manger, the choir of King's College, Cambridge, directed by Philip Ledger, who actually made that arrangement. And before that, we heard No Room at the Inn by Gervase Finn, and that was from his book A Wain in a Manger. W-A-Y-N-E in a manger, as opposed to Away in a Manger, all read by Diana Rigg. Diana, you were saying as we were listening to that how moving you find carol concerts, and sometimes you just look at the words, and you were mentioning another carol that you particularly love.
In the Bleak Midwinter, yes, it's absolutely extraordinary as a poem. Earth stood hard as iron, water like a stone. The images are quite extraordinary.
Thank you so much for joining us for this Christmas edition of Private Passions, Diana Rigg.
I've loved every minute.
Dame Diana Rigg was talking to Michael Barclay. Next week on Private Passions, Michael's guest will be the journalist and broadcaster Simon Hoggart. Private Passions is a classic arts production for Radio 3. The producer of today's programme was Sarah Cropper. Well, a very good afternoon from me, John Shea, with you this Sunday afternoon here on Radio 3. In a couple of minutes, Lucy Skeeping is here with the Early Music Show. But now, with the time at 1 o'clock, here's the latest BBC News from Vaughan Savage.
The former chief whip, Andrew Mitchell, has given his own account of his row with police officers in Downing Street, which cost him his job. Writing in the Sunday Times, Mr. Mitchell says he was the victim of a smear campaign aimed at toxifying the Conservative Party, and again denies calling the officers plebs. A police officer who's alleged to have lied about witnessing the confrontation has been arrested. Flooding caused by heavy rain is continuing to cause problems in southwest England, South Wales and eastern Scotland. Homes have been evacuated in Stonehaven near Aberdeen and Stoke Cannon north of Exeter. One severe flood warning remains in force in Cornwall, and there are more than 450 other flood warnings and alerts across the UK. The main opposition group in Egypt says it will challenge the result of a poll on a controversial new draft constitution. The National Salvation Front says the referendum was marred by fraud. Preliminary results suggest the Islamic-backed constitution will be passed with more than 60% of the vote. A huge fire at a market in the Afghan capital Kabul has destroyed at least 600 shops. No one was injured. It's thought the blaze was caused by an electrical short circuit. South Korea says North Korea has developed the technology to fire a missile more than 6,000 miles, potentially putting western parts of the United States within range. But defense officials say there's no evidence that Pyongyang has the ability to actually deliver a warhead. India's record-breaking batsman, Sachin Tendulkar, has announced his retirement from one-day international cricket. He's the world's leading run scorer in the one-day game with more than 18,000 runs. In a statement, he thanked his supporters and said he felt blessed to have been part of last year's World Cup winning team. The weather: there'll be more rain this afternoon across Scotland and the far south of England, but other areas will be generally dry with some brighter spells. Further heavy rain is forecast for the southwest of England tonight. The BBC News and Weather at 1:02.
From Vaughan Savage. In our Sunday concert in an hour's time, a rare outing for Grieg's complete incidental music to Peer Gynt. That's at 2:00. But before that, let's join Lucy Skeeping for the Early Music Show.
It was in the first part of the 8th century that the Venerable Bede wrote the famous lines, "They are not angles but angels." He was relating a story from about 100 years earlier, in which Pope Gregory, seeing some English slaves in the marketplace in Rome, was struck by their fair complexion and fine features. It's a lovely story, and legend has it that it led to England's conversion to Christianity. Certainly, the idea of angels as benevolent supernatural beings is one of the most inspiring in the Christian faith. They play their part in countless musical works, and many paintings show in great detail angels playing all sorts of instruments, from the psaltery and harp to the lute, organ and fiddle, to name just a few. And it was images like these that inspired a group of musicians in Paris in the years around 1900, La Société des Instruments Anciens. The idea was to give historical performances in which they presented to the public an eclectic mix of early music, all played on what were then considered to be a wildly exotic range of instruments. Of course, the early music scene has come a long way since the days when audiences would flock to the South Bank to see, say, a lute, a kirtle or a crumhorn for the very first time. There was great excitement back then. And in 2010, four young UK-based musicians decided to get together to recreate something of that feeling. Harking back to their predecessors, they call themselves the Society of Strange and Ancient Instruments. And earlier this month, they gave a concert in Manchester at the Royal Northern College of Music that featured a selection of still relatively, shall we say, unusual instruments, including the hurdy-gurdy, the nickel harper, the hardanger fiddle, the bass violin and the oud, alongside the now more familiar baroque guitar, viola da gamba and many more. We're going to dip into their performance for some highlights in today's programme. The title was The Ministry of Angels, and we'll hear all sorts of music relating to these winged messengers who are so often depicted making music themselves. In this first set, one of the 13th century cantigas of Alfonso the Wise, a collection of some 400 songs in the Galician Portuguese language, all relating to Marian miracles and, of course, to angels. And either side, to start and end the set, two anonymous traditional songs from the same period.
Thank you.